The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Welcome to Tone and Tenor, a show that explores current issues of the day and listens to bipartisan voices of the people. We want to hear from you with your phone calls and on social media. Now, here are the hosts of Tone and Tenor.
Welcome to the Tone and Tenor Show, Bipartisan Voices of the People. I'm Randall Jefferson.
I'm Maurice Goodman.
Our show looks at major issues impacting the nation and region from a bipartisan perspective. We want to hear from you, our listeners. Call, ask questions of our guests. Our call-in number is 1-888-329-3306. That's 1-888-329-3306. Our phone lines are now open. You can also send us your comments via social media. Our Twitter handle is @ToneAndTenor. You can also like us on our Facebook page. Just type in the words Tone and Tenor in the Facebook search engine to find us. Our show topic today is America focused and aware? Upcoming midterms and cybersecurity.
In studio, we anticipate Mr. Robert Arlett, 5th District Council member on the Sussex County Council in Delaware. Prior to his election, Councilman Arlett served as the Republican chairman for the 38th Representative District in Sussex County. Mr. Arlett, a Republican, is one of three candidates seeking to become Delaware's Republican nominee for the U.S. Senate. Vying for Democratic nomination is incumbent Senator Tom Carper, who is being challenged by Carrie Evelyn Harris, who is the Program Director for Achievement Matters. The winners of the September 6th primary will then move on to the general election as their party's nominee for the U.S. Senate. Mr. Arlett, born in Rhode Island but raised in South Carolina, found his way to the nation's second smallest state in 2005 when he started a real estate business and put down roots with his family in coastal Sussex County. The son of a career U.S. naval officer, Mr. Arlett, has lived in many areas of the United States, including California, Hawaii, and Virginia, where he attended George Mason University and enlisted in the Naval Reserve. There, Mr. Arlett served as an intelligence specialist with top secret security clearance before eventually leaving and coming to Delaware. Later on in the show, in the second half hour, we will have Ambassador Richard Castlerick, co-director, Center for Energy Science and Policy. He's a visiting professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Ambassador Carlick is the interim director of the Peace Operations Program. Since 2014, Ambassador Castlerick has been co-director of the Center for Energy and Science and Policy and served as deputy director, Terrorism, Transnational Crime, and Corruption Center at George Mason University from 2011 to 2013. Ambassador Castlerick was National Intelligence Officer for Europe on the National Intelligence Council, Office of the Director of National Intelligence, from 2003 to 2011. He received the National Intelligence Distinguished Service Medal for his activities. In addition to his ambassadorial assignments, Ambassador Castlerick has served at U.S. embassies in Ethiopia, Israel, and Togo. Ambassador Castlerick received his AA from Black Hawk College, his BA from Valparaiso University, and his MA from Indiana University and the University of Michigan. He will be on in our second half of the show, but currently now we have Councilman Robert Arlett of the 5th Council in Delaware here in the studio with us. Welcome, Mr. Arlett. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. Now that we're here, it was an exciting trip to get into the studio, but we are so very honored to be here. We're so very grateful to you both. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. We're glad to have you. You know, we're going to just dive right on in. You know, one, we're great to have you. You know, we are neighboring to you, Pennsylvania, Delaware. As we read earlier, as you were coming in, it's the second smallest state in the union. And you're vying for the Republican nominee for U.S. Senate, which you have two opponents that are also going, and you will, if you are the winner or whomever is the winner, will either go against the winner of the Carper-Harris race.
Yes.
Councilman, what made you decide to join this race? You know, all across the country there is a lot of new blood going in, a lot of new faces coming in from all walks of life into races all across the country. What prompted you to join?
It's a great question, and I'm not new to this. I will share with you that we have been in this battle and this fight for several years back in Delaware, because we have leadership, or lack of leadership, I should say, representation in Washington, D.C., from the state of Delaware. And that's ultimately why we've decided to do what we're doing, because we have somebody who's ineffective, who has forgotten about the people, and I'm hearing it over and over and over again for several years. And so we are doing this for very simple, to win and to make a difference back in Washington, D.C., for the great state of Delaware.
Mm. You know, as the – if you were to win, what are your platforms? What will people look at you to do? What would you be willing to do? I know the area of Sussex County where you come from, great place down there, Jimmy's Grill, always
sure.
Stop there.
Yeah.
You know, Rehoboth Beach area, coming down 13th. So
yes, sir.
How will you be in that small area? I know Frank Perdue, the Perdue's down there. Mm-hmm. What will you do differently than what Tom Carper is now doing for the state of Delaware?
Well, number one, I would start to listen. I think that's something that he has no longer done. I think the fact of the matter is Senator Carper is so ineffective because he is removed from the people. As you've just stated, you've been down to Sussex County. Sussex County is, I think, very symbolic of who we are as a state and who we are as a country. Very family oriented, very, very, basic, family values, mm-hmm. Hardworking people, community based. We care about each other. We care about our communities. And that's Sussex County. Truly, I believe that's the Delaware way, which has been lost. And also, of course, that is who we are as a nation. We are a caring and compassionate country, more so than any others in this world. That's Sussex County. That's what our campaign is all about. It is about families. It's about freedoms, right? Our independence. Mm. That's who we are as a nation. That's who we are as people in our great state of Delaware. We are the first state. And I think that's the voice that we're going to bring back. We're going to bring the people's voice back into Washington, D.C. that has been missing for so long. Mm. Senator Carper and so many others in Washington, D.C. are removed from reality. Mm. We are a real family that we've had some real struggles, like many other families in our nation. And I'm very relatable because I am one of us. Mm. I am a regular guy. And that's what is missing from Washington, D.C., is real people with real experiences that are going to bring real solutions. That's what we need back in Washington, D.C.
Well, certainly you spoke about the key here, our families and the issues they are facing, which
yes,
speaks to the economy.
Absolutely.
And a couple of the key things that are happening out there is the economy, although it's showing signs of life. We just got the unemployment numbers. The numbers have come down a little bit. But still, in Delaware and other areas in the country, the economy is a very big issue. What do you bring to the table as one of three candidates in the race
yes.
That differentiates you? What have you done
sure.
In terms of economics and other items that differentiates you from some of the other candidates and gives you a shot at Carper?
Oh, I think the reality is, first and foremost, let it be understood that the day I announced is the exact same day that Senator Carper came after me. Now, you think about that for a minute. Somebody that's been in office for 42 years, right? He's been in public office for 42 years. This is going into his fourth term, which he won't happen, but he's been in office as a U.S. Senator for 18 years. The day I announced, he came after me. So think about what that means. He is fearful of our campaign. He's fearful of the message that we're going to bring to Delaware and back to the country, because we are going to expose what he has not done. And that's something that's so very important. So specifically to answer your question, I'm a married man of 29 years to the same woman. That's something that's really important that we all understand. When I say I do, I mean it. Mm-hmm. That's number one. Number two is I'm a father. I'm a father of two. And that's something that is so very near and dear to my heart is family. Because growing up, I came from a broken family. Mm-hmm. I came as the sixth child, and I was the result of my mom having an affair.
Mm-hmm.
I came from a broken family. I understand the struggles and the importance of having a family unit, mm-hmm. making the family number one. That has been lost in our country. That has been lost. I'm a veteran. I understand what it means to raise that right hand and to defend that U.S. Constitution, willing to do so And I was honored and happy to do that. We are a military family who loves our country, who understands that freedom is not free. Freedom is not free. We take very great pride in who we are as a family and as a nation and what we have done to step up to lead that charge. Also a small businessman. I understand what it means to write and sign that check on the front versus the back. I understand the struggles of the bubble that we all experienced 10, 8, 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. I understand what that means. And so we're a real family again that has had real experiences. So we are excited to bring back some common sense back into the equation, back into Delaware, and back into Washington D.C.
So give us some examples of some of the things that a Senator Arlett would show to the other 99 senators and to that citizen in North Wilmington. Sure. All the way down to that citizen in South Sussex County. What are we going to see?
What we're going to see is somebody who's relatable to them.
Sure.
And what I mean by that specifically is the best thing for our economy is for somebody to have a job. The best thing for our crime statistics in the city of Wilmington is for somebody to have a job. The best thing for our education in the city of Wilmington specifically is to teach them, not just to get an education, but to teach them how to go out and have a job. And that's the part that's been removed from Delaware for so long. I will share with you, since Senator Carper's been in office as a U.S. Senator for the last 18 years, manufacturing jobs in the state of Delaware have decreased by 36%. That's his record. He's been in office for so long. We also know that the city of Wilmington is considered the murder capital of the country per capita. It's considered that. Well, guess what? This has all happened on his watch. He can't continue to say that he's part of the solution when he has actually been the problem. I'll repeat that. Senator Carper has been in office for 42 years. We have real issues in the state of Delaware with our economy, with wages, with manufacturing jobs, with our education, with our crime rates. Well, guess what? All things come to fruition. And it all points back to Senator Carper is the problem and no longer the solution. I'm bringing the solutions back into the state of Delaware.
But, you know, with all due respect to Senator Carper, we're talking about one person. Wouldn't that incorporate all of the House and Senate folks that allowed jobs, allowed the economy of Delaware to go backwards, so to speak? How will you, as a senator,
sure,
reverse, since Senator Carper, this is Senator Carper, how will you reverse what Senator Carper has said or done and bring Wilmington, not just Wilmington, but the state of Delaware back? Yes, you lost the major car dealerships, manufacturer, right?
Yes, yes.
You know, and they tried to save it. What and how will you bring jobs back? You know, we always hear during election time three things: jobs, education, and our elderly.
Yes.
But once they get in office, no matter whether it's local, state, or federal, the folks are forgotten, the people that put you there. How will you reinvigorate the economy of Delaware?
I think, number one, again, I'll get back to my point of listening. I think that when you say that the elected officials are removed because they no longer listen or are in tune with you as the family, and as we've been out there campaigning, we have had a series of town halls throughout our state, because it's important for me to understand one thing, that God gave me two ears and one mouth for a reason. I'm supposed to listen and learn much more so than I speak. Most politicians speak and do very little listening. And so what I have been doing is a series of town halls to include the health care. We've had a healthcare town hall series. That was the first one we did over Newark, Delaware, back in June. The second one we had was for our veterans. We had a veterans town hall in southern Delaware so we could listen and learn from our veterans. And Senator Carper is a veteran, as am I. They are so dissatisfied with what he's done for our veterans. It is despicable. And just because you are a veteran doesn't mean you care for the veterans. Just because you've been in office for 42 years doesn't mean you've actually gotten results and care for the people. So, again, I think to your point is I'm listening. And we are going to act, because I've actually acted as a council member. I am an elected official today, and I've been in office 4 years. and we have been the agent of change in the state of Delaware for 4 years, because very few people, I'll get back to your point, the Delaware way has been kick the can down the road and tell people what they want to hear and do little. Mm-hmm. That's evidenced by the continued issues that we have in our state. These are not just opinions. These are facts. You can't dispute the facts of what I've just talked about as far as our manufacturing jobs, the lost wages as compared to many other states around this nation. We are 45th out of 50 when it comes to crime. That's not something to be very proud of. And again, why is that? Well, let's get back to the economy and jobs. Idle time is evil time. When you don't have a job, when you're not feeling productive for your family, you have a tendency to get yourselves in trouble. I think it's human nature across all demographics. Advice I was given many years ago is that the idle time is evil time, so stay productive. Mm-hmm. So again, we've got to get back down to the basics. What are we doing to attract new companies, new industries into the state of Delaware? As a council member, I've actually done that. I have a track record of doing just that. What has Senator Carper done in the last 18 years as a U.S. senator to attract new industries in our state? I think the answer would be none, because nobody can ever answer that very question.
And to that point, you are going after Senator Carper. However, you do have two other people in a primary coming up in September 6th.
I do.
Who would beg to differ that you're going to have that chance to go after Senator Carper, and that would be in the name of Mr. Gene Truano and Mr. Rocky De La Fuente. You are not the endorsed candidate of the Republican Party. Mr. Truano is.
That's not true.
Is that not true?
No, sir.
So we got wrong information on that.
I'm not surprised. There is no endorsed candidate.
There is no endorsed candidate.
No, sir.
Okay, gotcha.
No. I'll explain why, if I may. I will share with you that I announced my candidacy 12 days before the state convention. 12 days. Mm-hmm. My opponent, Gene Truano, by the way, just came into our party less than a year ago. He crashed the Republican Party in the state of Delaware. He is not a Republican by nature. He has no history of being a Republican. I actually have a history as being a lifelong conservative Republican, because of my record and what I've done as a person my entire life. He has zero record. Mm-hmm. The only support he has is all based on his words and no action. That's the difference. I'm a person of action. He is a person of words. It's very simple. So to answer your point, at the convention, you had to have 60% of the delegate votes, 60% at that convention. Nobody did. Nobody received that 60%. So I was actually able to prevent him just 12 days prior announcing my candidacy. 12 days. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. After he was out there for 6-plus months campaigning, in 12 days, I was able to halt that endorsement from anybody. So I was very proud of that.
And the interesting thing is we're seeing that in Real Clear Politics, they did a poll between July 24th and July 29th, and
yes,
they found you at 19% versus Mr. Truano at 15% and the last candidate, Mr. De La Fuente, at 7%. So you're at,
yes,
a plus 4 right now,
yes,
in the polls. By now, people are beginning to pay attention to that. So
sure,
the key question they're going to be speaking about, not just but economics, but also education. Education's a key issue,
sure,
in Delaware. What are going to be some of the policies you're going to be presenting to the people who now are paying attention to you now?
Yes.
Actually have you leading in the polls.
Sure.
A lot of time before September. Well, now less than a little more than a month before the primary.
Sure.
And then on to November. What are you going to be telling them in terms of education policy, for instance?
Gets back down to my original concept and original action of listening. I don't have all the answers. What I want to do is learn from the experts. And I'm not just saying that by words. I've actually already as a candidate have actually sat down and had a tour from a superintendent in one of the school districts in Wilmington. I actually had a tour of DuPont Middle School with the superintendent, and I had a tour for 3 hours. In that building, we listened to students, we listened to teachers, we listened to admin, and obviously the superintendent. No other candidates have ever done that. None. And so just through that process alone, we learned from then what they want, what we need. And what the message was, and I'm not going to overly simplify this, but we have limited time, but the simplification from listening from them, the experts, is very simple, is to deregulate and get rid of the red tape. Allow educators to get back into the schools and to educate instead of all the other bureaucracies, all of the other things that exist. That seems to be the problem. It's the best way to educate your kids is closest to the families. I'm not a believer of the national opinions coming into our state explaining to us how we should best educate our kids. And for that matter, even the state of Delaware. The Delaware State Association, Educators Association, is what they do is they tell the superintendents and the school boards what they need to do as far as to get the numbers so they can go back to Washington and get the money. They're not educating. That's my whole point. And that's what they want. They want to just educate. So I want to get rid of the bureaucracy, get rid of the regulations so these educators can start to educate. That was the number one message that I received that day.
Just a thought.
Yes, sir.
Now, we call here at Tone and Center, we call Washington the dysfunctional family.
Yes.
And the dysfunctionality is that folks don't want to quietly, they want to work with each other behind the scenes, but publicly, they don't. How will you be able to cross that divide and come together and be able to get your Democratic colleagues, your independent colleague, and if you're so elected, and the Republicans to come together? Because even the Republican Party is divided right now.
Yes.
How will you be a catalyst to try to bring some healing within the political atmosphere in Washington?
I think it's with a servant's heart. I think my heart is to be a servant to the people and not to the party and not to the partisanship. To me, it's truly about serving the people. That's where my heart is. That's what we need as elected officials. I will share with you soon after I was elected in my current position, just under 4 years ago, somebody had stated, "Oh, you're that political guy." I was out in the community, and I was with somebody. He goes, "No, Rob is not a politician. He's a servant to others, and he is an ambassador." The point, though, is which means that I'm not a politician. I'm elected by the people to serve the people. And that's what we want to do. We want to get back to serving the people and not our party. And it's so frustrating because I think so many Americans can relate. Every single January when we listen to the presidential State of the Union, right? It doesn't make a difference who's the president. The opposition party will sit on their hands. Isn't it time we have some people in Congress that will start to stand for the American people? Rob Arlett will stand for the American people. Rob Arlett will stand for Delawareans. That's the message here. We're going to be putting our first state first, finally. Putting our families first, finally. Putting our country first, finally. Instead of the partisan politics that exists in the dysfunctional family in Washington, D.C., and the dysfunctional families that exist in Dover in the state of Delaware.
So to piggyback on Randall's point, there is another senator. His name is Mr. Chris Coons,
yeah.
You well know.
I do know Chris.
You have a state that you have to face these following things. A port, a very viable port, which has its challenges.
Yes.
A large farm sector, which is into the south from Sussex, Newcastle, et cetera. And then Wilmington, North Wilmington, and the challenges North Wilmington goes through. Very disparate, but very, very, very close in because it's a small state.
Sure.
In working with Senator Coons with some of those issues, be it corruption in the finances, in the financial services sector, mm-hmm. back to education, onto the economy and how to help that probably challenged farm sector, work with that port sector that needs to be revitalized. How are you going to bring about some policies? What are some examples of what you have done prior to your run that's going to show us, show Delawareans, that you're going to be ready to work with him on those big issues out there?
Well, first and foremost, Chris and I actually like each other. I actually have his cell phone number right here in my phone. We communicate on a regular basis. So we actually like each other because we both have sons that wrestle. So he's a wrestling dad, as am I. And we actually have hung out together in a gym as opposing teams, as a matter of fact. And so we actually do like each other a lot. And there's a mutual respect. And I think that's first and foremost. We actually like each other. So I can share with you that I will ensure that Senator Chris Coons understands that who we serve in Delaware are the people and not the party. That's the number – I'm just telling you, that's the number one message. It's time we have balance back in our state. Mm-hmm. The Delaware way used to be that we all work together for the common good of our people. The Delaware way today is do what you're told and don't rock the boat. Let me repeat that. The Delaware way today is do not rock the boat and do what you're said. I've experienced that because if people truly did care about our families in Delaware, then why do you have so many people that are registered as Democrats but always vote as Republicans? Because of the fear of retribution. That fear is alive and well in our state. That fear exists because of the political elite that has been in office for 40 plus years, for example, like Senator Carper and some others that have forgotten about the people and all they care about is their power and getting reelected. And I don't care. I'm up for reelection right now in my current position. I'm happy to share with you that I'm not running again. I am so unique in that sense because many people, and legally I could have. Mm-hmm. I chose not to. This is not about me owning a seat and having quote-unquote power. It's about serving Delaware. That's where our heart is, and that's what we're going to do. So I look forward to working with Senator Coons in making sure that we do just that and hold him accountable on focusing on the people, the Delaware way versus the partisanship.
About a minute or so left, but one of the questions you definitely have to ask is you have an immigration issue in Delaware.
Yes.
As councilman, you've tackled it.
Yes.
Tell the public how you dealt with it. You know, don't have a lot of time, but
sure.
How you've dealt with it and how you'll deal with it as a senator.
Well, I think it's a personal thing for me because my wife is a legal immigrant. My wife was not born in America. She came here through the legal pathway, her and her family. And we are a country and a nation of immigrants. We need immigrants. Yes. These families came into our country because they have aspirations and dreams like all others around this world. But we also are a country of laws. And so I'm going to tackle that quite simply by sharing and showing compassion for others. But at the same time is that we have to abide by the laws. And Congress is charged with the immigration. It's not the president. It's Congress. And Senator Coons and Senator Carper have not done their job to tackle that properly. We have about 30% above the national average as it relates to illegal immigrants in our state. That takes jobs away from our residents. That adds an additional expense to our residents because of the schools. We have a real issue. I'm going to tackle those by solving these issues. But we're going to do it the right way and the lawful way and the legal way. We're going to bring, again, Delaware back on track, and we're going to care for our families first. I care about the immigrants, the illegal immigrants. Let me rephrase that, the illegal immigrants, but not over our citizens of our state.
Very good. That we greatly appreciate it. So far, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Mr. Robert Arlett, who's the 5th District Council member on the Sussex County Council in Delaware and candidate, Republican primary candidate for the U.S. Senate. Before you go,
yes, sir.
Mr. Arlett, would you please give our listening audience the ways by which they can reach out to you, email, social media,
sure.
et cetera?
I appreciate that. Yes, please do visit our website, RobArlett, ArLett.com. We are on Facebook. We are on Twitter. And come learn about who we are. Learn about who – this is your campaign. If you're ready for change in Delaware, I'm your candidate. If you want status quo, then I'm not that guy. We are the agent of change. If you are ready for change, Delaware, Rob Arlett is your candidate, and Republicans need to get out on September the 6th, Thursday, to vote Rob Arlett to be your candidate in the Republican Party to go against Senator Carper. We are that guy. We're ready to go.
Well, it sounds like you just declared Senator Carper the winner.
There is a process, but I think based on that poll, he's up by 30-some-odd%, and I think he is definitely the candidate to beat. And he's also fearful of me and my candidacy. I will remind yet again that I was the only candidate of the three that are on the R side that he has come out after. That tells you a lot right there. We are the one that's going to put him down.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening to us here. And to Mr. Arlett, thank you for your time. We appreciate that. We're going to take a quick break. Our show's topic today is America Focused and Aware. Upcoming midterms and cybersecurity. We're coming up on at 2:30 hour with Ambassador Richard Castlerick for the cybersecurity side of that question here on Tone and Tenor, Bipartisan Voices of the People.
The Tone and Tenor Show is sponsored by Factotum Business and Government Solutions, a unique lobby consulting company that services business and governmental clients through long-standing bipartisan relationships. It is Factotum's mission to provide business solutions for both profit and nonprofit organizations, connecting them to officials in local, state, and federal governments. Factotum has offices in Pennsylvania and Washington, D.C. For more information on Factotum Business and Government Solutions, call 866-795-4484. That's 866-795-4484.
Welcome back to the Tone and Tenor Radio Show, Bipartisan Voices of the People. We just had on with us Mr. Robert Arlett, 5th District Council Member of Sussex County, Delaware, and a Republican primary candidate for the United States Senate. In just a moment, we're going to have with us Ambassador Richard Castlerick, who is the co-director and Center for Energy Science and Policy and visiting professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University, discussing cybersecurity and the new cyber center that was just brought online the other day. We currently now have Ambassador Castlerick on the phone. Ambassador Castlerick, welcome to the Tone and Tenor Radio Show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you this afternoon.
Thank you for that. We greatly appreciate it. We brought you on because we knew that there's been this big conversation about cybersecurity, and as fate would have it, a lot of cybersecurity conversation happened within the last 24 hours, where you had the FBI director, Homeland Security director, and a few others at the podium at the White House, press briefing room at the White House, telling us chapter and verse how they are going to be attacking the specific issue of Russian meddling. And then yet here you are on the show, so we're either very prescient or you saw us coming, one or the other.
Well, my area of interest and background is the cyber issue as it relates to energy, but believe it or not, the two are connected.
Well, you know, tell us about that. I mean, right now we just had a cybersecurity center being propped up, and then you had those principals come to the microphone.
Right.
To what degree, Ambassador, what degree of trouble are we in a cybersecurity perspective? Give us that 10,000-foot view as before we drill down a bit.
Sure. And you know, part of the issue here is, as you mentioned, there's been a lot of attention in the last 24 hours, and so I think there's a tendency for people to say, gee, this is a problem that just started yesterday. To the extent that I've been following this in the energy area, we've seen cases of Russia attacking electrical grid systems in Ukraine as early as 2015 and again in 2017. They went after Estonia even earlier. Mm-hmm. So there's a history of cyber threat coming from sovereign nations, specifically Russia, over the last few years. I think what has gotten the real attention here has been the convergence with our own electoral process 2016, and now, as you point out, where the heads of the intelligence and security structures of the United States have basically stood up a center to deal with what our midterm elections.
Director Coates, spoke specifically, said it was just one click away. Dan Coates said yesterday, one click away from, let's see, the Russians specifically disrupting a lot of our space in cyberspace. The energy grid, since you are very, very sure. focused in on energy, at what risk is our energy grid?
Well, I think there's a great risk to cyber attack. I mean, if the Russian state has shown the capability of being able to intervene and get into computers at the DNC and other individuals and actors, they certainly can get into to other networks which are vulnerable, and the electrical grid is one of those. There was a really fascinating article. If you've really it's quite a lengthy read, but it's in Wired magazine. Wired is one of these geeky kind of magazines, but the title is How an Entire Nation Became Russia's Test Lab for Cyber War. And it goes through chapter and verse in far more detail than I, as kind of a layperson in all this, can fathom, but just exactly how the Russians used their attacks twice on the Ukraine electrical grid to send a political message and disrupt power. The risk is, and I think even Vice President Pence, who whether it was yesterday or the day before, gave this speech about cyber. He pointed specifically to the vulnerability of our power grid. So, yes, I think we do need to be concerned. And why is that? Because our power grid is essentially not controlled by the government as it is in Ukraine, but controlled by private industry and the technology that's being used for good to improve the not only the production of electricity but its transmission also introduces vulnerabilities because it, you know, as we noted earlier, if they can get into a computer at the DNC, they can get into a computer involved in electrical power as well. And the more our grid becomes decentralized with renewable energy and kind of if you will, independent producers even at the household level, then you've got even more vulnerabilities introduced there. So it's a problem, and the way you address it, and we've looked at this at George Mason. We've had a series of conferences and hope to have another one this fall, which sort of stresses the importance of collaboration and cooperation among government, private sector, and the public at large, because it's only that way that we're going to be able to understand the vulnerabilities and do something about it. And as I said, the Wired piece that I mentioned is describes exactly why that kind of cooperation is critical.
Mm. Well, Ambassador, so what does explain to the layperson out there this introduction of the cyber security center that Secretary Nielsen of Homeland mm-hmm. Security introduced to us this week? What will that do? First, mm-hmm. what is it? Then, yeah. what will it do? Will mm-hmm. it protect us now that we seem to be in an active threat scenario? And will it be sustainable?
Well, I have to go back to the time that I spent in the intelligence community in the early 2000s. I was National Intelligence Officer for Europe, working in with the then DNI. And we stood up at that time in the intelligence community kind of fusion centers like the one we're talking about today to deal with proliferation and counterterrorism. And what these centers allow you to do is to take the expertise that rests out there. You know, you just saw the tip of the iceberg in terms of the leadership of the U.S. intelligence community on television the other day. But you've got really gifted analysts throughout DOD, FBI, CIA, NSA working on this issue. The center allows you to pull those people together, essentially, and get them working on a very, very specific problem, and to do it in ways that kind of aren't hampered by, you know, one person working for CIA and one person working for DOD.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes an opportunity to bring the talent together to focus on a specific problem. Now, will it be successful? How are you going to measure success? Well, maybe in this particular case, it will be the degree of Russian involvement or lack thereof in the midterm elections. But I have a sense that this is part of a concern about, you know, again, as Vice President Pence talked about, this broader threat that the United States faces of cyber, potentially cyber warfare. Russia being the first real threat to have to be concerned about, but not alone Russia. He mentioned China and potentially terrorist groups or criminal groups as well, who are not state actors but non-state actors, but able to get into to U.S. and other systems.
Indeed. Sorry.
The last point is that we really need to cooperate with our allies. We really, in Europe, they are facing exactly the same problem. So with the British, the Germans, the French, even Estonia. I mean, Estonia, the small little Baltic country, in my humble opinion, they're probably best equipped to cooperate because they've been hammered by the Russians already, and they've figured out how to respond to it. So, you know, this is not only a whole of government in the U.S. side, but it's how do you cooperate with our allies because this is it's a global problem.
So, Ambassador, to that point, and that's got to be a concern. If you think through it for a second, and I know you have, We are at trade war with China, who also is very aggressive in cybersecurity warfare. And we have a tepid relationship with the EU, which we want to be friends one day, and the next day we want to throw punches at them. And we have the Russians who are coming at us 24/7 to the point where it seems like it's going to come to a head. Is this center going to – looks like it's going to have proof of concept almost immediately. What does one do if the Chinese decide tomorrow – to not necessarily work with the Russians, but in tandem while the Russians are coming after us, decide to do their own cyber attack because we have thrown so many tariffs at them and are feeling that's the only way they can come at us. How are we going to manage all of that?
Well, look, the one thing I would say, I don't imagine the center is going to be dealing with some of these trade issues as serious as they are that we have with China. And even in cases where we're talking about protection of intellectual property and technology involved in manufacturing processes, in my mind at least, I put that aside as a separate but extremely serious issue that as a matter of policy we have to deal with and we have to go after the Chinese on. Would the Chinese be involved in, again, let's go back to a hack of American elections or our electrical system? I don't know. All I can say is I know the Russians have already.
Right.
So,
mm-hmm.
this isn't something in terms of their involvement, it's a theoretical question. And here I am. I'm a European guy. I mean, that's been my background in state and as I said in the intelligence community. I just don't see the Chinese having the same incentives that the Russians do to do what they're doing. And I could be proved wrong in the next 24 hours, But I just don't have a sense that they represent the kind of threat that Russia does, and potentially Iran. If we end up going nose to nose with the Iranians even more than we are already, I know from my 3 years I was ambassador in Azerbaijan, which borders Iran, how capable the Iranians can be. Even though they're small and their level of sophistication may not be as great as Russia's or others. The Iranians have, if you will, the motivation and have shown the capability of trying to get involved and disrupt us. Remember, it wasn't that long ago that reportedly, the U.S. and others fried the Iranian nuclear centrifuges through essentially what you could call a cyber war effort.
With intelligence agencies coordinating amongst each other to get there?
Yeah, well, I only know what I know from the papers. I'm no more – but I'm just saying that again, it's you have to look at this not only in terms of capabilities – But intent, and that's where I make a distinction between China and Russia, and to a certain extent, Iran. And I guess I would throw North Korea into the mix too. Again, as a kind of a minor player, but someone who's we've seen already active in kind of a minor cyber war effort.
Mm. Ambassador, paint a picture for us of what the Russians are capable of. You've been alluding to it in Europe. We know a few years ago, maybe my memory's not serving me well here, where Russia probably, not organically, but just physically shut down the gas pipelines to Western Europe. To what degree would we be at risk, based on the experience you have seen in Europe, by which the Russians could not just work through cybersecurity in terms of grids, but also flows of gasoline, oil, infrastructure, paint a picture for us of what this true threat could be to us.
Well, I think the pipeline issue that you referred to was when the Russians essentially cut off the supply of natural gas through the pipeline system that went through through Ukraine to Western Europe. And that was, you know, on their side, that was an effort to put the screws to the Ukrainians at a very early stage in that conflict. They've taken a more sophisticated approach. We're not gonna cut off the flow of gas to Europe. We're going to build pipelines that go around Ukraine. So now you've got all this attention to the so-called Nord Stream 2 pipeline that goes under the Baltic to Germany. And then the so-called Turk Stream pipeline that goes from Russia through Turkey and then to Europe. And you look at a map and you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to say, hey, these guys are building pipelines so they won't have to ship gas, and won't ship gas through Ukraine. So that threat is always there. I don't see them using, gas as a, if you will, a negative incentive. I think I see it more as a positive incentive to provide Europe with non-Ukrainian transportation routes for natural gas. Oil doesn't fit in the same category since oil is more of a global commodity, and the pipelines that date from the Soviet period moving oil to Europe, you know, are supplemented globally by supplies of oil.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the case of even gas now, we've seen President Trump, you mentioned our friend and foe relationship with the EU. Well, when President Juncker of the EU was here, he talked about, you know, buying more natural gas from the United States. So, you know, our LNG becomes an element too in that. So I think energy, while a political issue, is kind of changed in its character in terms of how the Russians view that. But the cyber part is a real risk, and continues to be, I think, for, and you're seeing this, you know, everybody in Europe seems to have caught this great concern now for this issue, and I think they're trying to figure out exactly what they can do too to decrease their vulnerabilities.
And I appreciate that segue, because then the question then becomes, to what degree is there coordination between the EU and the U.S. when they bring online this cyber center? Is there going to be coordination? Was there discussions during the EU catfight that happened just a month ago, or was it more catfight and not substantive conversations like this?
Well, my guess would be, and again, I'm guessing here, based on my own experience, our first points of contact would be, you know, between the intelligence services in Europe and the U.S. intelligence community. That's always the framework, and you know, we have a long history of bilateral relationships as well as relationships within the framework of NATO. So if there's an organization, if you will, NATO compared to the EU that the U.S. would go to with this issue, I think the first choice would be NATO. And there's, again, over the last decade, there's been a lot of work done within NATO framework on cybersecurity. So it's not an issue that would be new, and my guess is that the kinds of discussions that would take place within, you know, sort of the national security intelligence community framework would start with our closest allies on the intelligence side, expand to NATO, and then to the extent there were issues that needed to be taken up with the EU that involve things, you know, of a regulatory nature or cooperation on how we might increase security for electrical grids, that would be more of a could be more of a discussion to have with the EU. I don't know if that was discussed when Juncker was here. My guess is it's being discussed now, you know, separately through either our mission to the EU or through our embassies in Europe.
Brexit. To what degree is the pickle that Prime Minister May is in terms of working her way through Brexit,
right,
and that disrupting that coordination between the EU, the U.S. and other nations? Does that leave the United Kingdom susceptible to more cyber issues? Will that make a terrorist more inclined to go after them as a separator from the EU? It's like, well, you're away from them and you're not as coordinated as you could be. You're sort of alone. We can go after you and pinpoint. Could that be a problem, or is that just a stretch?
Well, look, I'm by I. I'm biased against the British leaving the EU. I've found over the years that certainly just looking at it in terms of U.S. interests, and I know this isn't the position of the current administration, mm-hmm. but we always found it far more valuable to have the British, our closest ally, you know, within the EU framework, because in a sense they have historically provided a sense of balance over some of the more extreme positions that some EU member countries would take. Now, would Brexit, to the extent it happens in the near term, would that make a difference in terms of cyber vulnerability? I'm not sure the UK would be any more vulnerable to cyber attacks. Certainly the cooperation with the US would continue. As long as Brexit hasn't happened, they're still in the EU. Mm. I mean, tomorrow, if something came up, I mean, they're still in the EU framework, so it's not as if their voice is totally silenced. Mm. But it's not helpful for the British or the EU or for the US interests, which are paramount in all this, for the UK to leave the EU. But that's beyond my ability to influence, and certainly, you know, I don't think this administration is opposed to Britain leaving the EU.
Mm-hmm. As I know, we have a couple of minutes left. We mm-hmm. did want to hit you with one or two questions, one of which is sure. Congress. Is there a comprehensive cybersecurity policy coming from Congress to the administration? Certainly the administration has already made a decision on the center. What is Congress doing to work with the president, the executive branch, to give us a comprehensive cybersecurity policy? If you were in the room, if you were in committee and having that discussion, what would you present, you know, if there is not one?
Well, yeah, if there is not one. I have not followed, to be honest, what the Congress is doing right now on cyber. I know historically they've been supportive. Because they recognize, you know, for their own constituents as well as the country, what the threat is that these cyber attacks could pose. But I'm just not that. I don't have my finger on the pulse of mm-hmm. what's going on the Hill now. I mean, we're all getting distracted by Russian sanctions sure. and kind of these broader issues. And but my sense would be that if those heads of the intelligence community that appeared at the White House briefing room went up to the Hill and said, members, we need A, B, and C if we're going to make this anti-cyber effort work. And I think A, B, and C would be money and legislation in particular. My guess is there wouldn't be much objection to that from either Republicans or Democrats. It just don't, but you know, again, I'm not on top of the congressional side as much as I would yeah. need to be to answer your question fully.
No problem. We can only hope. Last question. And this is a weird kind of doomsday question, but will we have a cyber war? And if we have a cyber war, will we win it?
Well, there are those, and I don't want to be too extreme about this, who say we may be already in it as a cyber war, just given the evidence of what the Russians have been up to, particularly in Ukraine, but also Georgia, and some of the things that have been going on in the Baltic region. People are operating in cyberspace as if, you know, 100 years ago we would move naval vessels around the world to confront enemies or would-be enemies or put pressure on people. So the cyber domain is already an area, a gray area of conflict, where a lot of rules have not been written. I don't think even within the NATO framework we know exactly what it would take for a cyber attack to trigger Article 5, which is the collective self-defense provisions of the NATO treaty. Mm-hmm. you know, what would it be? Take out the banking system in Estonia, take out the electrical system in a NATO member country, or find malicious software in a voting machine in Pennsylvania. I don't know what it would take. But I think we need to start asking those kinds of questions of, you know, what defines war in cyberspace? What defines appropriate responses if those red lines are crossed? And then how do we cooperate with our allies to win the war?
Indeed. Thank you for that. Ambassador, Council Rick, just about 30 seconds left. If you would give our audience a way by which they can engage you and reach out to you by email, by social media.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Rich Kauz, K-A-U-Z, and my email address here at George Mason is rkauzlar@gmu.edu. And if you can't keep track of all that, just hit George Mason's website. Look for me. You'll find all that stuff.
We want to thank you for being a guest on today's show. We want to thank our guest, Ambassador Kasowicz.
Yeah,
he is the co-director of the Center for Energy Science and Policy, otherwise known as CEPS, visiting professor at Scholar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. And we also like to thank Mr. Robert Arlette, 5th District Councilman, member of the Sussex County Council in Delaware. He is vying for the Republican primary nomination for the United States Senate, and that election is September 6th in the smallest state in the Union, Delaware. Listeners, follow our show on social media. Our Twitter handle is @ToneAndTenor. To find us on Facebook, just type in www.facebook.com/ToneTenor, all one word, to find our page. Our studio engineer today was Mr. Brett Kronenberger. Thank you, Brett. I'm Randall Jefferson.
I'm Maurice Goodman.
Thank you for listening to Tone and Tenor, Bipartisan Voices of People, here on WWDB Talk 860 AM out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Thanks a lot.